Okay, we're doing our Parsha summary class, and we'll dedicate our learning tonight to Rav Pesen Zatzal. Our Parsha is Parshat Vayishlach. We'll do a quick overview. We saw at the end of last week's Parsha, Avraham knows that he's coming back to the land of Israel. Angels have come to greet him, and he left on very bad terms with his brother, so he sends messengers in front of him, and he sends word to him. So said your servant Yaakov, I've been delayed until now by Laban. I have different cattle and maids, and I wanted to find favor in your eyes now that I'm returning. And the messengers come back, and they say, we came to Esav, he's coming towards you with 400 men, he's coming to kill you. And Yaakov is very scared, so he divides the nation, he divides the wealth, and he says, if Esav attacks one camp, at least the other camp will escape. And he turns to God, and he says, the God of my forefathers, who told me to return to my land, and that things will be good, I must have diminished my rights from all the kindness that you've done for me. For when I came out of the land of Israel, I had only one staff, and now I number two camps. I know that I must have diminished my merits with all the good that you've given me. Please save me from the hands of my brother, from the hands of Esav. I'm scared that he'll come and kill my wife and kids. I know you told me you'll make everything good for me, but what about them? You said my seed will be like the sand by the sea. And please, Hashem, he sleeps there that night and he prepares a gift, large gifts of cattle and servants to give Esav. And he tells them, when you meet up with Esav, tell him that I sent you and that I'm coming, I'm following up in the rear. So they're all going ahead of him. And that night, he grabs his wives and his kids and he runs. They're going to tell Esav, Yaakov's picking up in the rear. Esav's going to continue following the groups of flocks. He's headed in that direction, and Yaakov's going the other way. So Yaakov's trying to trick him, but God has another thing in mind. So as Yaakov is crossing everyone over, he comes back for a few vessels he left behind, and the man comes and attacks him and fights him all night long. And the man cannot win him. That man is none other than the angel of Esav. And the angel cannot overtake him, but what he can do is give him a low blow on the inner thigh. And now Yaakov is limping. And Yaakov has him in a headlock, and he's holding on to Yaakov. And he says, fine, let me go, it's morning. And Yaakov says, no, no, you must bless me. And he says, what's your name? He says, Yaakov. He says, no, your name is going to be Yisrael. Yisrael means one who has overpowered angels. Yaakov says, and what's your name? So he says, what are you asking for? And he blesses him. Yaakov names the place Peniel, for he faced El. He saw a godly being face to face. The sun rises, and he's limping. And because of that, we don't eat the Gidon Asher. And he looks up, and there's Esav. His trick didn't work. God delayed him, and he's going to have to meet up with Esav. And Esav charges ahead with his 400 men. Yaakov quickly splits Leah and Rachel and the other two wives and their kids. And he goes before them and he bows seven times as he approaches his brother. And Esav runs towards him and he hugs him and he kisses him and they weep. And he sees the family and he says, who are they? And he says, the kids that God granted your servant. And everyone sees him bowing. They all go forward and bow. And Esav says, what was all the camp I met beforehand? And he says, I want to find favor in your eyes. Esav says, I have so much. Take what's yours. And Yaakov says, no, I want to find favor in your eyes. Take my gift, because seeing you is like seeing the angel. Take the gift I sent you, for God gave me everything I need. And he insists, and Esav takes it. Esav says, let's travel together. And Yaakov says, no, I got kids, I got students, I got cattle here, I can't go in one day at your pace, and all the sheep will die. You go ahead, and I'll go at my pace, and eventually I'll come to my master, to your hometown. Esav says, I'll leave some of my troops with you, and Yaakov says, why bother, everything's okay. Esav goes his way, and Yaakov travels to Sukkot, and he spends a year and a half there. Throughout that year and a half, he's sending gifts to Esav to placate him. Yaakov comes home to the city of Shechem, and he has to do something in recognition and thanks of what he received. So he makes a social institution. He purchases a plot of land and he stays there. His daughter goes out to see the girls. She's abducted by Hamor. He takes her and sleeps with Shechem, the son of Hamor, the prince. And he sleeps with her forcibly and he does what he likes. And he pains her and he decides he wants her as his wife. So he tells his father, take me this girl as a wife. And Yaakov hears what's happened, but it's over, it's happened. What's he supposed to do now? His sons are out at the field, so against his will he's silent. The king comes to him to talk to him, and as he's talking to Yaakov nicely and pleasantly, the sons walk in from the field, and they're very upset. And Hamor tells them, you know, my son Shechem wants your daughter, give her as a wife. You marry us, and we'll give you our daughters, and we'll be one big happy family. You'll do good business here, you'll live with us in the land. And Shechem, now the son opens his mouth and says, tell me what you want, I'll give you a lot of gifts for this girl. I want her as my wife. And they answer him with cunning, and they say, we can't do this, you know, by us. When we want to insult someone, we tell them, you uncircumcised one. It's a shame to us that our sister should be married to uncircumcised people. If you'll agree to circumcise like us and circumcise all the men in your town, then we'll join you and we'll become one nation. And if not, we're taking our girl and we're going. And Hamor and Shechem are very happy with the idea, and they're quick to do this. Now Hamor and Shechem come and convince the townsmen, and they all circumcise, and by 3 days they're all finished circumcising, and Yaakov's two sons, Shimon and Levi, draw their swords, and they walk into the city, and they kill all the men of the city. They kill the king, Hamor, and his son Shechem, and they take their sister Dinah, who doesn't want to leave at this point, as we will discuss, and they go out. And the rest of the family comes and loots the city. And Yaakov turns to Shimon and Levi, look at what you've done to me, he says. Now the other nations will think I'm a threat to them, and they'll come and attack us. And they answer, will he make our sister into a woman of ill repute? And God tells Yaakov, go to Beit El and bring the sacrifice you promised me. You have a hand in this, Yaakov. You took a vow and you didn't live up to a vow, and that endangers one's children when one doesn't live up to his own vows. And Yaakov cleanses the family, says, get rid of all the idols you brought into our home, and they bury them, and they travel, and he brings a sacrifice. And before he makes it to bring a sacrifice, he hears that his mother died, and God gives him the name Yisrael, and God tells him he will have the land of Israel. Yaakov starts traveling, and Rachel has difficulty at childbirth, and she dies as she gives birth to her young son, Binyamin, the one son to be born in the land of Israel. After she passes away, we have the story of Reuven, which is described as, it's described in harsh terms, that he slept with his father's concubine. We have a tradition that's not what happened. And the pasuk quickly reinstates Reuven as one of the 12 tribes. Yitzchak passes away, and we have the genealogy of Esav at the end of our parsha. The kings of Esav, the 8 kings that preceded our first king, Moshe Rabbeinu. So let's begin the parsha with more depth. Chazal tell us that Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim, whenever we read about the forefathers, we have to understand that within the stories of the forefathers is an allusion as to what's going to happen to us, and there's great wisdom in the way that Yaakov deals with his brother. There are errors and there are points to learn from. And that's where we turn to Chazal to learn from them on which points Yaakov did right and on which points Yaakov did wrong, and how we are to deal with Esav. When the sages used to go to Rome to deal with the Roman Empire, they would spend time learning this parasha before they would go to Rome. After World War II, there was a rabbi who was fundraising for building a school for the kids after the Holocaust to try and help them build their lives again. And he found himself on the subway, he's on the train, and he has a sizable amount of cash on him. And sitting across from him on the train are 3 people who are eyeing him. And he sees these 3 guys talking, and he knows that he's not such a weak man, but he's not such a strong man. There are 3 and he's 1. And they're eyeing him and they're talking. And he's wondering, what am I going to do? These funds are so important, and people just gave him the donations. And if they jump him, he's never going to be able to collect those funds again, and the kids need this school. And he's standing there, and he's sitting in his seat, and they're sitting opposite him, and they start whispering. And he thinks for a minute, and he says, we are taught that the answer to all problems is in the Torah. We just have to know how to access them. And he thinks, and we'll come back to the story later in our parasha. Yaakov sends messengers to Esav, his brother. And our sages say Yaakov did an error. His error stemmed from fear. fear is an important part of life. It's an intelligent part of life. A person is supposed to be fearful. But once a person has done what he's supposed to do, a person has to move forward and do what's right. And sometimes when we let the fear overtake us, when we let the fear push us beyond the call of duty, at those times we can make mistakes. Chazal tell us a person has to be careful not to be too cautious. As it says, Ramchal says that overcaution is also improper, it is also a mistake. And Yaakov, we are taught, Yaakov over here was overcautious. Esav would have gone his merry way. Yaakov wasn't even coming near Esav. What was Yaakov sending him a letter for? I'm coming and I'm sorry and everything's going to be okay. Who asked you? Yaakov made a mistake. Our sages say it's like someone who walks by a wild dog and the dog is lying there peacefully and he figures I'll lean over and just brush his head and wag his ears and everything's going to be okay. Machzik bo znei chelev. It's like someone who grabs the ears of a dog, Ovel mitaber al riv lo lo, someone who walks by, there's a fight that has nothing to do with him. Two gangs are fighting with one another. He's on the other side of the street. He says, guys, let me help you work it out. What are you getting involved? Chazal say, Machzik boz nechelev. It's like grabbing a dog by its ears. Ovel mitaber al riv lo lo, someone who walks by and decides he's going to get involved in a fight that has nothing to do with him. And Chazal say that's what Yaakov Avinu did in our parsha. He aroused Esav. And Chazal say that historically, we keep repeating this error. The Jewish people are always extra fearful of the Western civilization, of the Roman civilization, of the American, Russian, however you'll view it. We are always extra fearful and we go the extra mile. If you want to look at politics today, I don't think there's another nation on the planet that treats Mr. Obama with the respect that Netanyahu does. I don't think there's a nation on the planet, if you just read the newspapers today, I don't think there's any other country that goes beyond, above and beyond, to placate the American president. Quite the contrary. Look at what's happening all around. Yaakov Avinu says, let me just make sure everything's okay. So he sends him word. And in sending him word, he arouses Esav to attack. Messengers come back and they say, you think he's your brother, he's Esav. And the hallmark of Esav is that he doesn't let go of his anger. One of the hallmarks of a Jew is that a Jew is willing to forgo, he's willing to forgive. When King David comes to the Givonim, which were a tribe that tricked us into letting them join the Jewish people, so we didn't want to renege on our promise, even though the promise that we'd protect them and that we let them become part of our people was made under false pretenses. They lied to us, and based on that we accepted them. Nonetheless, for the sake of the sanctity of God's name, it was decided in Joshua's day that we will not turn them away. And we fought a war to protect them. And in King David's day, there was an issue that there was a drought. And after 3 years of drought, they asked God, why is this drought happening? And God said, because when King Saul murdered the people of the city of Nob, the Kohanim, so there were some members of this tribe that also, they lost their livelihood and they ended up dying. Yes?
When you're talking about like how everybody, we have like a history of kind of like going out of our way to kind of like getting everyone else in business to try to make sure everything's okay. And reminded me of this movie, it's called The Believer. It's based on a true story, actually. It's about this Jewish guy that ends up becoming like the end of the movie, a neo-Nazi, and by the end of the movie, he starts like coming back or whatever, right? But he starts like trying to make a point about like, because everybody like complains about like they don't like the Jewish people, and he says, okay, so why is it that you know people don't like the Jews? Is it because they're so clannish, like they stick together so much, or is it because they always stick in and knows everyone else's business? I mean, like saying like all these things that contradict each other, like is it because like you know they hold on to their money so tight is because they're so flashy with their money or whatever, all this other stuff, these stereotypes and everything like that. And just when you're talking about like about the people that are kind of sticking their nose in everyone else's business, I mean it just reminds me of that, it's funny, but at the same time like we try to stay out of other people's problems as well.
The idea is that he tried to be over nice and he tried to be oversensitive. He tried to send word. I just want to make sure it's okay. I'm coming back. Well, who asked you to make sure it's okay with him? He wasn't sticking his nose so much in Esav's business as much as trying to make sure Esav is really okay with him. Trying to make sure he's really fine. Yeah. God told you to go back. Go. So King David calls in the Givonim and he says, there's a drought and for 3 years now we have no rain. And God has said that it's because you were wronged in the previous kingdom of King Saul, and I'd like you to forgive the Jewish people for how you were wronged. And the Givonim say, we lost people's lives. We want King Saul to lose from his family people's lives. And David says, wait, come on. Why don't you forgive the Jewish people? And they say, no, a life for a life. And David says, well, let me make good to you guys. I'll pay you off. And the Givonim say, no, a life for a life. And David says, no, tell me a price. Come on, let's work something out. And they say, no. And then David says, okay, maybe when they're all together, they're toughies. He sends them all home, and he calls them in one at a time to interview them. And he offers each one, maybe, you know, for this amount of money, would you agree? No. For this, no. We want people dead. And after David HaMelech sees that, David HaMelech says, I have no choice. God told me I have to placate them, because without that, the Jewish people are finished. And yet, David makes an earth-shattering halachic declaration. He says, the Givonim are not Jews. You guys ever hear of such a concept? A rabbi could put together a court and decide a whole group of people are not Jews. End of story, not Jews. So he puts together the high court of the Jewish people, and he makes a declaration that they're not Jews, and from that day onward, the Givonim are not Jews. So they got what they wanted. They killed people from Saul's family, and those people were left hanging. But David HaMelech said, there are three traits of the Jewish people. Baishanim, Rachmanim, Gomlei Chasadim. They get embarrassed, they are merciful, they're willing to forgive, and they do kindness with others. Those are the hallmarks of a Jew. And anyone who doesn't have those is not a Jew. And so if these people were so steadfast with their revenge, they're not Jewish. That is what we see in Esau. 20 years have passed and he's so successful. What does he care? Yaakov has a little bit of sheep. Why is that his concern? Ve'evrato shemar ha-netzach. His anger remains for eternity. He will not forgive. And Yaakov's very scared. Yaakov says, wait a second. Esav said all along, he's only going to touch me after my father's dead. Could it be my father died already? And Yaakov divides the nation. Our tradition is that in times of danger, a person has to divide his camp, divide his assets. A person should never put all his assets in one place. A third should be in properties, a third should be in business, and a third should be liquid in cash. Chazal said, always divide your assets. Everyone's saying gold is going up and up and up. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. Go figure what's going to be now with Chinese inflation. Maybe gold's going to go back down. No one knows. Oil's going up and up. Yeah, suddenly yesterday went down. Who knows? Do we know? Do we put all our assets in one place? No. Person always has to divide his assets. People are sometimes gung-ho. This is the girl of my dreams. Good, marry her. But she's not willing to marry me. Oh, so you'll chase after her for 30 years till you're a 70-year-old man? Some people never give up. You don't bet on one horse. You don't bet on one girl. I don't mean to juxtapose the two. You see the girl of your dreams? Run after her. Try to get her. Marry her. But if it doesn't work, so realize there are other places to go. Yaakov teaches us the concept. You don't put all your money in one place. He divides the camp. And he says, if one camp falls, then the other camp will escape. And this is our tradition. That Hashem always leaves us room to run away. Meaning, when Jews were being persecuted in Germany, so Jews were able to run to Palestine, to the United States. There were always places where Jews could run away. Hashem divided the world among empires, and we have a tradition that the idea behind it was to ensure that there will always be a place for the monotheists to run away. There will always be moments of persecution, and there will always be a place to run away. So when we run away, Yaakov divides the camp. He says at least half will get away. People sometimes think a bad thing can't happen. A bad thing could happen. Chazal consistently teaches we have no guarantee that nothing bad will happen. People sometimes say, the state of Israel will never fall. Who guaranteed that? I don't know of any such guarantee. Iran is a real threat, and the Palestinian Authority is a real threat, and Egypt is a real threat, and Jordan is becoming a real threat, and Syria is a real threat. Yes, there are many real threats out there. Do we have a guarantee everything's going to work out? No one has a guarantee. We have a guarantee that someone will make it. That the Jewish people as a people will not be annihilated. We have no guarantee on the masses. And so Yaakov Avinu divides the camp. He says, who knows who's going to make it out alive? And he turns to God. Yaakov prepares with the three basics. He gives the gifts. He does basic ishtadlus. He tries to bribe Esav. And he prepares for war, and he prepares in prayer. After he's prepared the essentials down on earth, he turns to heaven. And he turns to God in prayer, and he says, Hashem, you told me everything will be good. I know I don't deserve it, but help me out. When he prepares for war, he has his children wear their armor underneath and wear their Shabbos clothes on top. You look at them from a distance, everything's nice and beautiful. Under all that, they were ready for war. He prepares the gifts. And the Torah makes special mention how many male rams and how many female rams, how many male goats, how many female goats, how many male sheep, how many female sheep. Chazal tell us he was a shepherd and he understood how many men, males, it takes to impregnate how many females. He understood this. This was his science. Chazal say we see here that different animals have different mating cycles. And Chazal tell us this is a concept that we apply also to human beings. Different human beings have different mating cycles. How so? Chazal gave us the responsibility of a couple, how often they're supposed to be intimate. And Chazal said there's a minimum that every couple must have, and that is based on what they do for a livelihood. A guy who travels through the desert and he's home once a year, so you can't expect him to be with his wife more than once a year. His wife can't say, well, honey, I want you home every night. I want you home at least twice a week. Once a week. She can't do that. You married a sailor. The sailor's out at sea half a year at a time or a year at a time. You knew you were marrying a sailor. So Chazal said different jobs require a different amount of time that people spend together. And it's very interesting that Chazal gave us a minimum. It's not the maximum, it's the minimum. But Chazal said, the wife expects, based on her husband's free time, that there's a certain minimum that he has to give her to show her that she's important to him. Just this week, a guy came to me that his wife is demanding divorce. And at the root of it all is that he doesn't have time for her. It's just, he says, it's not so important. Well, it is important. Chazal said, we see here, Yaakov Avinu took an accounting with animals. How many males does it take to impregnate how many females? How much time does each one spend with the other? Well, Chazal told us that we have a biblical responsibility. Husbands have to know there is a minimum amount of time that a husband owes his wife, and less than that is called that he's not living up to his duties as a husband. Yaakov Avinu sends the gifts to his brother. Traditionally, bribing always helped. A lot of Jews were saved from the Nazis through bribing. There are many famous stories about it, and a person has to know that gifts are a very important part of life. I don't know. Almost everywhere we go goes through gifts. Jews have always been good gift givers. And it's something which we have to learn here at the Machon. Whenever guys go home for Pesach or Hanukkah or whatever, I always ask guys, are you bringing gifts? And they always say, my parents have everything. I don't buy that. No. We give gifts to Esav, and we have to learn how to give gifts at home too. Your parents haven't seen you, they're supporting you, they're funding you. A normal person brings gifts. Everywhere we find in Tanakh, Avraham Avinu sent Eliezer with gifts. Wherever you go, a normal person brings gifts. You guys are coming home, bring gifts. And you have to know that gifts are not only about your own family. Gifts are also about the offices you have to deal with. If you're in a college and there's a registrar, you went to Israel, bring her back, and I love Israel. Bring her something from Israel. It'll cost you 5 shekel, 10 shekel. It'll make her day. She got a souvenir from Israel. When you'll call her 5 years down the road, you'll need your resume. You'll need your transcript. You'll need something from her. Believe me, she'll go out of her way because you made a relationship. You showed her she's important. We have to learn from Yaakov Avinu. The use of gifts is a very, very special tool. And people are willing to work with it. Now we enter the Christmas season. So yeah, we don't celebrate Christmas and New Year's. But at the same time, we have to know that sometimes if there's a guard in front of your building or there's the super in the building you live in and they do celebrate these holidays, then it's a nice thing to give them a bottle of wine or something. You're in Yiddish, they call it schmearing. You know what that means? You're greasing the wheels. The wheels will turn better. I spoke to a businessman who told me that the way he gets all his cheap apartments is he always brings gifts to the super. And the super always lets him know when apartments are going to be available before anyone else knows, and that's how he gets his apartment. So the super, it costs him a bottle of wine a year, a bottle of whiskey, It costs him $150, and he makes a few tens of thousands of dollars on it. It's a worthwhile exchange. The super's happy. He's happy. It's a concept that we use over and over again in our history. And in times of danger, we use it as well. Many Jews were saved from the Nazis through bribing and throughout our history. Yes?
I was going to say, for example, like,
I purposely gave that example. When you're giving him a gift, you're not supporting his religion. You're simply indicating that you value the work he does.
That's like a concept in like their whole thing or whatever, that they give gifts on holiday, and it's kind of like they're not kind of participating in the pagan, right?
Okay, so ask your local Orthodox rabbi. I gave the example on purpose. Yaakov passes everyone over and he goes back for a few bottles he left behind. Our sages say when a person is meticulously honest, then every penny counts. People sometimes think that if you're a pious person, so then you don't bother with the small things. And Chazal repeatedly shows that it's the other way around. If you're a meticulously honest person, then every penny you've made is made honestly, through hard work, and every penny counts even more. And then a person has a hard time giving up on things for nothing. There was a rabbi here who lived across the street from the Shuk, Rav Waldenberg, when he used to go to the pharmacy to buy his whatever he needed, his supplies, he'd always bring back the same bag they gave him last time he went. How could you throw out a bag? You could reuse it. Every penny counts. When you're a meticulously honest person, then every penny counts. So Yaakov, even though he's just before war with Esav and everything's on the brink, but that's his habit. He doesn't leave behind old earthenware vessels. And he goes back and his children make an error. Here the old man is going back and no one goes back with him. So Yaakov goes alone. And he has to fend with Esav's angel all alone. And Esav's angel sees he can't hit him. So he hits him where it hurts. He hits him on the inner thigh. And in hitting him, he effectively damages all future generations. He creates the capacity to harm the sages of generations. Nachmanides quotes, they used to take iron bulls, heat them up in fire, and put them in rabbis' armpits, burning their most sensitive areas. And they torture rabbis to death, literally. And we have on tradition that the capacity of the Roman Empire to torture our sages stemmed from this fight. This fight was about the future. And although the angel of Esav could not overcome him, meaning the future is still in our hands, but he could hurt him. And that is the concept of Dorosh el Shmad, that there were generations where they did everything they could to cause us to leave our faith, be it the Inquisition or the Muslims who persecuted and tortured and killed the Jews. Throughout our history, they've had the capacity to hurt us, although they couldn't annihilate us. And the capacity to hurt us, we have on tradition, began on that night. And that night began with Yaakov's children letting their father go back alone. When he comes back, the children realize they made an error. And so they take upon themselves that they will never again eat that gid anoshe that was hurt in that battle. Now, in that battle, the great point of that battle is that Yaakov is victorious. Notice, when Yaakov left Israel, he saw a vision of the ladder, and he saw Esav's angel going up and up and up, and he can't bring him down. Remember that angel he saw in last week's parasha? Well, in this week's parasha, he brought him down. In this week's parasha, that angel can't get away. The angel says, "Let me go." And Yaakov says, "No." And the angel says, "Well, what's your name?" And Yaakov says, "Well, it's Yaakov." And he says, "No, no, 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 no. Yaakov was until today. Until today, you did things in a roundabout way. You didn't see me face to face. Everything you did was with trickery and hiding. Now you saw me face to face and you won. That's Yisrael, Yashar, straight. Sarita, you're the master. You won." We have a tradition that when, it's not a tradition, it's a pasuk in Daniel, that whenever a war is about to take place down below, the angels first have it out up above. So here, Esav's angel had it out with Yaakov, and Yaakov won, which is the prelude to what's about to happen here on earth below. So Yaakov is limping. And Yaakov looks up, and there's Esav, his twin brother, that hairy being, almost 100 years old, but he's going to take Yaakov down. And Esav's coming with 400 men, and Yaakov is concerned because the Noahides are not responsible to give up their lives on the Noahide laws. We have a responsibility to give up our life rather than kill someone else. They don't have that responsibility. They don't have to give up their lives for the Noahide laws. So Yaakov says to himself, I'm going to kill these people because they're coming to kill me. They're coming to kill me because otherwise Esav is going to kill them. Who says they deserve to be killed? But I don't have a choice. If they're going to come kill me, I got to kill them. And he divides up the family. And the person of prime concern in this encounter is Rachel. Because when Yaakov married Leah, Esav sent word, that's okay, you took my wife, I'll take your wife. And so the one that they're most concerned about is Rachel. Because Rachel is good looking. And Esav has already expressed his interest in taking Rachel from Yaakov. Yaakov goes before them and bows 7 times. The 7th blessing he received was that he will be master over Esav. And his 7 bowings is indicative of the fact that I am not your master. I am bowing before you. Everyone bows. The one tribe that did not bow to Esav is Binyamin. Binyamin is the one to be born in Israel, and that's why Binyamin has the Holy of Holies in his section, because he didn't bow to Esav. Esav runs towards him, and there's a machlokas in Chazal. What was Esav going to do? Was Esav coming to kill him or kiss him? Machlokas in the machlokas Tanoim. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, we have a tradition that is known that Esav hates Yaakov. But our relationship with Esav consistently was this dual relationship. Love and hate, and love and hate, and back and forth. Ask anyone that dealt with American representatives. Same relationship. One day they show up to a meeting and we're the best of friends and our ties are irrevocable and our peace treaties are something you could count on. The next day they're putting pressure like crazy. We have on tradition that Esav stuck his fangs into Yaakov. When he kissed him, he bared his teeth and he figured, I'm going to kill him with my teeth. And at that moment, God made Yaakov's neck hard as a rock. And about that moment, it says, "Kemigdal Hashem Tzavarech," your neck is like an ivory tower. Esav takes a bite, and he's biting into stone. Yaakov's neck, boy, that must have really hurt, turned like solid rock. They both start crying. Esav looks around. He sees women. He sees kids. He asks, who are these? And Yaakov answers him in modesty. He says, these are the kids that God granted me. Notice he doesn't answer about the women.
Your servant.
Huh?
Your servant.
Yeah. The maids go and bow, but their sons don't. The sons say, we're sons of Yaakov. We don't bow to anyone. And Ibn Ezra has a very powerful line here. This is true. I sometimes quote one medrash and sometimes another. Right? The Chizkuni says, I'm sorry, not the Ibn Ezra, the Chizkuni says, the sons didn't bow because they said, their maids are mother, but we're sons of the master. We don't have to bow. But Rachel and Leah, when they saw their mothers, when Rachel and Leah's children saw their mothers, who weren't maids, when they saw them bow, so they bowed too. And the line that he says here is, he says, the way of people who are lower, the lower a person is, the more apt he is to be unusually proud. We've discussed many times that pride stems from falsehood. And a person, when he is really not fit for greatness, that's when he is more protective of his pride. Yosef goes before his mother. And Yosef figures, if my mother is the one in danger from Esav, then he's going to have to come through me to her. And I don't even want him to see her. And because Yosef steps forward before his mother, unlike the other tribes, he is blessed that no eye can take down Yosef. Yosef is above the evil eye. He is above the Ayin Hara. That's why people always say, Ben Porat Yosef, right? Yosef is above it all, because Yosef was willing to put himself before Esav's evil eye to ensure that his mother doesn't get seen by him. Let's take a step back, because there's a medrash that your kids are going to learn in Cheder, so you have to know it. The medrash says that the angel, the messengers that Yaakov sent in the beginning of the parasha, they weren't really human beings, they were angels. And the medrash says that when these angels came upon Esav, so Esav sees these tremendous knights riding towards his camp, and they ride past all his troops, they ride up to Esav, pull him off his horse and start beating him up. Esav can't take them on, and he's being beaten. Esav says, guys, wait a second, what did I do? Who are you? What are you doing? Keep beating. And the commander says, in martyr. They keep hitting. He says, wait, you guys know who I am? I'm Avraham Avinu's grandson. You know Avraham? No, can do. They keep beating. He says, you know, my father is a famous man, Yitzchak. You guys can't do this to me. They keep beating. He says, you know, my brother is Yaakov. You're Yaakov's brother. We're so sorry. They pick him up, straighten him out, brush him off. We're really, really sorry. Here you go. Put him back on his horse, ride off. Esav looks at them. Who were they? What was that? They continue riding. A few minutes later, a larger group of troops come. They ride up, same story. Again, they throw him off his horse. They start beating him. He pleads, I'm Avraham's grandson, Yitzchak. Finally, he says, I'm Yaakov's brother. You're Yaakov's brother. We're so sorry. Sir, forgive us. Pick him up, brush him off, put him on the horse. Keep riding. Time and time again, and Esav's wondering, according to this medrash, that's what Esav asks him. Who was that camp? Who were all those people? How are you so famous? Who was everyone who I bumped into on my way here? And Yaakov says, I want to find favor in your eyes. Chazal say that throughout the parasha, there's a dual level of conversation going on. There's the conversation we see on the surface, and then there are the things beneath the surface. According to one understanding, Yaakov tells him, I met your angel, we're okay, I took care of your godly forces. Esav says, Yesh li rav, so there's a joke they say in modern Israel, Vayomer Esav, Yesh li rav, Esav says, I have my rabbi. Meaning Esav says, I have a rabbi who says what I'm doing is also okay. People sometimes figure if the rabbi says it's okay, I don't have to worry. Well, which rabbi did you ask? If you look hard enough, a friend of mine once said he wants to open up a website. You punch in the shaila, you punch in the question, you punch in what answer you want to find, and then they'll search to see who says the answer you want. Right? What? California. What? I don't think it exists, but... so they say, what?
Instead of doctor shopping for a doctor that will prescribe you what you want, it's rabbi shopping.
Right. Yeah. So that's what they say, that Esav also said, Yesh li rav, I have a rabbi. But that's a joke, obviously, it's not what he was saying here. Yaakov gives him the gifts, Esav takes the gifts, there's a famous Avnei Nezer, there's a medrash here that says, Yaakov didn't want the wealth of Chutz Laaretz. The concept of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is that a person helps the economy here, that he lives off of the economy here. When they asked Avnei Nezer why all the Chassidish Rebbe's don't come to Israel, so his answer was, we're all funded by Chutz Laaretz anyways, that's not Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. He proves from a Tshuva and Gittin that the concept of Yishuv means to live off of the land. If you live by a river and your sustenance comes from the river, then you write in the get. The get was written by this city that's Yoshevet Alanahar, that's living by the river. But that's provided that there's a connection between the economy of the city and the river. If there is no connection, then you can't just say we're Yoshev Alanahar. Yoshev means to have sustenance from it, to have that your economy is connected to it. So the Avnei Nezer said, all the Hasidish Rebbe's would be funded by their Hasidim in Chutz Laaretz. That's not Yishuv Eretz Yisrael if you keep getting your paycheck from Chutz Laaretz. So Yaakov Avinu says, Esav, you could have all my wealth from Chutz Laaretz. I got to build the economy here in Israel. He comes in peace, and Chazal say that when a person is saved from a situation of danger in peace, then he has to do something, so to speak, to pay back society. So Yaakov Avinu does something. What does he do? Different opinions in the Medrash. One opinion says they didn't have a normal economy, they were only doing barter. he set up a form of currency. The other opinion says he set up infrastructure. They were all traveling on these paths and he came and paved roads. The third opinion says they were all stinky. They didn't have normal bathhouses. He said, you can't live in the Holy Land like this. He set up bathhouses for them, which the Talmud says is pikuach nefesh. The Talmud says being able to bathe and cleanse oneself is really a life-threatening need. And the fourth opinion is he set up an eruv, which needs explanation. He purchases the field he's living in, and the prince hears there's a good-looking girl that came to town. So how is he going to go to see the good-looking girl? So Dina is in the tent. She's a good, modest girl like her mother. But Shechem hires a bunch of girls to go out there and dance. And Chazal tell us the nature of any woman, young or old, is that they enjoy dancing. So there's a beat and there's a drum, there's a tambourine, and there are girls dancing. So she goes out to look. And when she goes out to look, he rides up and abducts her and he takes her. Notice he's called the Chivi. Chivi is the name of a nation. Chivi also comes from the word Chivia, the snake. And he takes her forcibly, and he sleeps with her forcibly, and he tortures her. What's the torture? She's lying there, and she says, how can you do this to me? No one's ever going to marry me. You ruined my life. It's not only about now, it's about the future. You destroyed me. Vayeaneha, Chazal say, inui is to withhold intimacy. Well, withholding intimacy from her was no torture. When we say on Yom Kippur, there's inui. One of the Torah says, v'initem nafshotechem, afflict yourself. The word inui, Chazal say, means that one, there are five terms. The word inui encompasses five things. We don't eat, we don't drink. We also, couples refrain. They hold themselves back from one another. That's one of the inui. So why over here was it vayeaneha that he tortured her? The torture wasn't the thought that my life is over. No one's going to marry me. I have no future. It wasn't only about the now, it was also about the future. And he decides, hey, she's a good-looking girl, she's the son of a wealthy noble, I want her. He talks to her and he sees she's brilliant. He comes to his father and for the first time, Dina is called a little girl. He says, get me that little girl for a wife. And Hamor thinks it's perfectly normal, as we find throughout the book of Bereishis, that the nations of the land, they view women as an object. And it's very interesting that today people think we've advanced. But if you look at the billboards all around, I mean, they advertise dogs more nicely than they advertise women. We're in a society that does the same thing. They advertise women as an object of desire. The women's lib has moved women's rights way back. A woman today is, I don't know if she's that much better off just because she could own land. The whole concept of relationships. I've been getting recently emails and phone calls and complaints from people who are not religious at all, but they want marriage, they want to build a home, and they don't realize that the whole society is against them. Meaning the system today, the system of people just getting into a house together and living together, and well, it's not about building a home, it's about using the woman, it's not about building anything with her. So throughout the book of Bereishis, this is one of the concepts that God stands up for. We find that when Sarah is abducted, God stands up. Rivka is almost abducted, and the story doesn't work out. God stands up for this. And each time the king says, what did I do? I thought she was his sister. And God says, what do you mean, what did you do? She's not a human being? Just because you want her, you could take her? Well, that was the given in the time. I met a woman about 25, 35 years ago. Who told me that she was once traveling here in Jerusalem. She was on a date, and an Arab sheik was visiting, and he stopped her date, and he asked him, sir, tell me, how many camels would it take for me to buy that girl? He didn't talk to her. He talked to the date. He thought it was her brother, her father. He asked him, how many camels would it take to take her off your hands? So this concept still exists around the Middle East. By us, it's not that way. It's never been that way. And when Hamor comes to Yaakov, Yaakov realizes it's over, it's been done. Meaning the Medrash says, the way of the world is that if someone wants to take someone else's daughter, he stands up and says, either you die or I die, but this isn't happening. That's the Lashon of the Medrash. The Medrash says a normal person, if someone wants to take his daughter, he draws his sword and says, one of us is leaving here dead, but you're not touching my daughter. That's what the Medrash says. So why is Yaakov silent? So the answer is because it was over already. And Yaakov is all alone. His children are out in the field. And Hamor comes and he's sweet-talking him. And Yaakov's silent. Yaakov's sons come in to the scene. They're seething, but they see their father sitting silent. They see Hamor doing all the talking. And they say this is wrong on two levels. Number one is we're a very important family. Has he no respect for the family of Yaakov? And they're very upset at themselves because they say, obviously we're not as great as we thought we were. Because if when he saw us, he didn't feel that this was something that he couldn't get away with, then there's something wrong with us. Meaning we'd expect that, you take advantage of peasants, it's wrong, but you think you'll get away with it. Why did he think he'd get away with doing this with us? And so the brothers of Yaakov, the Pasuk describes, were upset on two fronts. It says, Vayichar lahem and Vayitatzvu. There were two levels of pain. The first level was, what a terrible thing happened here. If a peasant's daughter is taken like this, it's a terrible thing. So that's the first level. What's going on here? But the second level was, it suddenly hit home. There's something wrong with us, because he felt that we're like anyone else. So then we're obviously not living up to the level we should be on, so that he would view us as men of God that he wouldn't dare touch. Hamor presents his case, and he tells them, look, he took your daughter, you'll take whatever daughters of ours you want. He figures he'll tell them, that's the way it works. In the future, you'll choose which girls to give us, but you'll be able to take girls, the girls are here for the taking. And you'll do business here, and we'll become one nation. And Shechem offers them whatever they want, and they say, we can't do that. You have a foreskin, it's a disgrace for us. If you take it off, we could talk. And they figure the whole nation is not going to agree to circumcise. And if they agree to circumcise, they'll all be in such pain that we're going to be able to walk in and take Dina back. No one other than Shimon and Levi is prepared to go and kill out the whole town. Yaakov isn't happy about what's going on because he doesn't like hearing his sons talk deceitfully. His whole life, Titen emet li Yaakov, he stood up for the truth. And now, whatever way you understand it, he stood up for the truth. His mother has to force him into the room. Go get those blessings. He's like a little boy at age 60. She's dressing him. She's putting the food in his hand. She says, you go, and I'm telling you. Because he wants to be true. He comes to love, and he does the best to be true. Everything he does his ishtadlus, but he tries to be true. And here he hears his sons. They're very easy to come and say something deceitful. So Hamor and Shechem go out. Shechem is a good politician. He sweet talks everyone. He promises the brothers one thing. He promises the townsmen another thing. Classical. And the people agree to circumcise. And they weren't ready for this. Now the people start cursing them. People are lying there in bed, bleeding, hurting. They don't know what the future holds for them. And Yaakov and his children see that the people are ready to go back on their deal. Shimon and Levi enter the town. They're young kids. They walk in, they draw their swords, and they kill everyone. And they come to take Dina out of the palace. They kill Shechem, they kill Hamor. And Dina says, what future do I have? No one's going to marry me now. What are you guys offering me? You want to take me out of here? But I have no life. It's over. And it's interesting that Chazal described this because this is, to a certain degree, the idea that the brothers blamed themselves, the idea that Dina didn't know if she'd have a future. A lot of this is discussed in modern psychology too, that a victim very often feels like his life is over. We're just going to finish the parasha, Michai, and then we could talk. The rest of the family sees all the men of the city are dead. They walk in and they loot the city. And Yaakov says to Shimon and Levi, you've endangered everyone what you just did. And we're not ready for this. And Shimon and Levi retort. Is he going to make our sister a woman of ill repute? Yaakov doesn't answer them. And the Torah over here doesn't give us more details as to what happened. There are midrashim that discuss great wars that ensued. These people, Hamor and Shechem, they had peace treaties with neighboring towns and they came and attacked. We have the classical midrash that says that Yaakov drew out his sword and stood by his children and declared, anyone who wants to come is taking on my family. And Hashem made a miracle, and they were all scared to attack. But there is a book called Sefer HaYashar that has whole chapters describing the wars that ensued after this. It wasn't so simple. Different sources, different recounting. What do you mean?
All these wars happening. Why doesn't anybody think of the children? I don't know.
Yaakov wasn't approve. He didn't approve of what they did. Yaakov held it against them till his last day. He says, where was I? What are you guys doing things on your own? We're a whole family. You endanger everyone and then you go on your own? What's going on here? Yaakov took a vow. Took a vow that he'd give a gift, and Chazal say when a person takes a vow and he doesn't live up to his vow, so that endangers his family. And the fact that Yaakov delayed his vow caused him to lose his wife Rachel and his daughter to suffer. Chazal say Shimon promised Dinah that she'd come into his house, machlokas whether he married her or she remained the rest of her life living a single spinster's life in Shimon's home. Chazal tell us she became pregnant from Shechem, and the brothers were ready to kill the baby that was born. They said, this baby is a shame to the family. His father was Shechem. And Yaakov grabbed the baby before the brothers could get their hands on it and put a special locket on that baby and sent it down for adoption to Egypt. And that baby was going to be Yosef's wife. The baby, the daughter of Shechem, is Osnas bas Potiphera. Potiphar was a eunuch. Potiphar was castrated in Pharaoh's court, so he wanted to adopt the baby. So they sent him this beautiful baby from Canaan. He was a noble. He adopted Yaakov's granddaughter. Yaakov was scared that his sons might not let the baby live. They held the baby was a product of a terrible thing. And Yaakov held, you don't kill the baby just for that. And so Yaakov took the baby and gave it a locket. And that baby became the future of the Messiah. Again, we see that the Messiah comes to the world in interesting ways. Specifically, through all of this act, that baby Osnas goes down to Egypt, and when Yosef needs a good kosher Jewish wife, well, Judaism goes after the mother. Yeah, he's going to end up marrying that baby.
How did that connect to Mashiach?
Well, from Yosef came Mashiach ben Yosef. Rivka passes away and there's no one around to bury her. Yitzchak's blind. Esav's out at the field. Yaakov's out far away. And she gets a very quiet burial. Not the burial we'd expect for a woman of her piety. And Yaakov is very pained by that. And we're out of time. We'll pick up Bezlat Shem. We'll try to finish our parsha tomorrow night.